Well, hi. Thank you. Some familiar faces, some new faces. My name is David Lankus, associate professor up at Syracuse. And this year, I have the enviable position of being on sabbatical. So, you know, you're lucky I wore pants today. And as part of that, I'm a fellow with the American Library Association's Office for Information Technology Policy. So that's my title du jour. And we've been here talking about question point and talking about different ideas and how we can take and work on some ideas. And I thought it'd be useful to give background to anyone who wants to. And so let me start with a little background on participatory librarianship, what it is and where it comes from. Participatory librarianship network is conversation. Library is conversation. About 2 years ago, before then there was probably some, but 2 years ago there was some serious policy movement afoot in Washington. And this was the time when, first of all, we were all people of the year from Time, and you know, everyone who was on MySpace was either being stalked or stalking. And so you know, the idea was, is there a really cool way that we can, in essence, keep our children safe by filtering everything in the world? And so this piece of legislation got introduced called DOPA, never a more appropriate name for a piece of legislation ever, Defense Against Online Predators Act. And what the legislation said was, we've already said that public libraries and K-12 schools, museums, and people accepting E-rate funds should filter, must filter to get E-rate funds. But we never really said what you have to filter. Well, good news. Now we know what you have to filter, and it's MySpace. But we can't actually write into a nice piece of legislation, thou shalt not MySpace in your schools, because you know, it's not really kosher. And so what we'll do is we will try and come up with a nice definition of social networking. Or, well, it's not just social networking, it's this or it's that. And such. And they ended up with great terminology like interactive website, and as opposed to the passive dead ones. And you know, and don't really worry too much about it, because after we pass the law, we'll form a national committee that will actually tell you each individual site you need to do. And so thus the Committee for Un-American Acts was formed yet again. The good news is the law didn't get passed, but it did get reintroduced the next year. And it's actually gotten, versions of it have gotten introduced at state levels. Clearly my politics are now on my sleeve, but what it is American Library Association, you may know, has a Washington office, and that Washington office has two parts. One part is lobbying, legislation. The other, divided by a Chinese wall, is a think tank called the Office for Information Technology Policy. And this got the people around the think tank saying, what's going on here? What are the longer term issues? How can we do this? Because if Congress are having trouble with it, we know that boards are probably having trouble with it as well. We know that all sorts of library organizations are probably having the same difficulty, right? Do we start a social network site at our library? Well, what does that mean? Does photo sharing and all these kinds of things went back and forth? And so there was a need to sort of think, get a handle on this topic, and so they came to us, and with my co-authors, Joanne Silverstein and Scott Nicholson, we began to think about what was going on here. And we were to write a tech brief, which we did, and I think I saw someone actually printed the thing out. And it was to look at the technology, and we started where everyone starts, with the, what is Web 2.0 social networking something or other? Well, it's Flickr, and it's this, and it's an API, and rah, rah, rah. And we came up with a really bad dictionary. And as this is a great sort of link onto this morning's presentation, because you know, you guys ended up the same place we did, which is we don't want to do this, and other people have done it. What's durable? Let's look past the functions and past the new sites and individual sites to what's the durable concept here. What's going on? You know, we talk about social networking, or that was my question if you were here this morning. You know, what do you mean by social? What do we mean by social? And if it just is, how do we deal with it? So what's going on? What are some durable concepts going on here? And from that paper, we came out of a series of challenges and recommendations. And so where did we end up? Well, we ended up looking at it, and what we ended up looking at is what's happening on these sites, whether they're social network sites, social media sites, is conversations. Why are people having conversations? Why are people seeking to engage in conversations? And we went back to some, God help us, theory, and ended up with something called conversation theory, as originally developed by a fellow by the name of Gordon Pask in the 70s, because he wanted to teach machines how to think, so he'd start with people. And he said, well, you know, here's this little bit of nugget of knowledge we can use, which is that knowledge is created through conversation. When we are seeking to understand something, when we are seeking to learn something, when we are seeking to absorb new knowledge, we do it through conversation. Now, here's where I get in trouble, because we put out some public drafts, and I got lots of people saying, define conversation for me now. So let me be really clear what I mean by conversation, by being really obscure. Conversation is two cognizing agents interchanging information. All right. Now, cognizing agents sounds like, boy, what a crappy Ivy League academic bull are you pulling on me now? But remember, Gordon Pask was interested in teaching machines how to think. And what he said is, in your head, you've got multiples. And you go, huh? You have a conversation with yourself. You do this in public. They lock you away. But the truth is, you do it. Right? When you're struggling with a new topic, even things like, how am I going to drive to work today? If I go left, I get the good bagel. If I go right, I get stuck in traffic. In instructional terms, we call this metacognition, sometimes called critical thinking. And we try and teach people how to, in essence, be reflective in their thinking. But we also then have conversations individually, conversations from one to groups. We have organizations have conversations with other organizations. We call them contract negotiations. We have policies and we have treaties that are formed by different groups. So it's a scalable idea. But what's happening is that these two agents, these two things, are engaging in conversation, and they're seeking agreements. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, do you agree with this? Yeah, I agree with that. Well, let's come up with a common definition. And these agreements become a sort of scaffold by which we come up with new agreements and new thoughts. All right, so welcome to Learning Theory 1.0. But what this means is that if libraries are in the knowledge business, and I don't think you're going to find many libraries that are going to argue that they're in the thing business or they're in the building business. They're going to say, we're a knowledge organization. We're about creating institutional knowledge. We're about creating community knowledge. That means they're in the conversation business. That means the primary reason for libraries to exist is to facilitate conversation. Now, we can facilitate those conversations with books and with videos and all these kinds of things, particularly in this metacognitive way. You're reading a book and you're sort of having a dialogue with yourself. But artifacts, books, websites, music, are just secondary objects. They're just the after and the very rather pale afterglow of true knowledge creation. Right? You've all done it. You have these great conversations where you really get into it, and then you stop at the end of the day and you write it down in the notes and you go, boy, that sounds a lot more boring than what it really was like. Right, because you can't capture the true interactions in the back and forth. And the other part is that knowledge is about learning, not about dissemination. If you're in the knowledge business, if you're in the learning business, you're in the idea of saying, did you get this? Right? It's that follow-up question. Did that make sense? Do you understand? Right? As opposed to, I'll dump a lot of stuff and I'll run away. Right, this is what we call the empty bucket approach to knowledge. Right, and this is how the sage on the stage, which is exactly the model we're in now, is formed. You are all empty buckets, and I'm throwing you bricks of knowledge that is plunking into your head, and you're going to walk out informed. Well, we've given up this idea a long time ago. Right, it's an active, constructive process. Even if you're sitting there, you're going, this guy's full of crap, or yeah, or oh, that reminds me of, or what about the, right? You're having a dialogue. It just may not be externally. That knowledge is an active and participatory process. Now, we're using participatory really specifically here because the word social you could put here, but the word social has a lot of baggage with it, as Jasmine, I'm sure you probably already dealt with, right? Are we talking about people just getting together and hanging out? Is, you know, a nightclub social? Is learning? What do we mean by social? Well, it means you're engaged and active. And it also means that all parties in that are engaged and active. So this idea that we are in the knowledge business, libraries are in the knowledge business, therefore they're in the conversation business and learning business, and they're in an active process, leads to this pressure for participation, which is, right now there are some of you who are perfectly content to sit in your chairs and listen, but there are some of you who are really annoyed by sitting in chairs and listening. And there's some that, right, I'm willing to admit it, I annoy more than most, but the idea is that people want to be active constructors of this. This is why we have question-answer periods at the end. This is why, if you look at higher education, moving to distance education, it's not a bunch of podcasts you download. It's usually a bunch of discussion forums in which people are talking back and forth. So people need to be an active constructor of their knowledge, and they want tools, therefore, that allow and facilitate conversation and participation. With me so far. Well, I can give you some example of this pressure and how this pressure shows up. And what I want to do is think about the internet for a minute and think about it in four layers. The bottom layer, the internet, is simply infrastructure. It's wires. It's what connects things back and forth, right? Or these days, it's not just wires. It's also waves and wires. But we have the infrastructure. On top of this infrastructure, we build a bunch of applications that move bits and back and forth over this infrastructure. So we have email, and we have web servers, and we have web clients and things like that. On top of that, we have information services that take these applications, add their own information to it, and send it over the infrastructure. Libraries, OCLC, Syracuse University. We sit here, right? And then at the top layer, we have the users who take the information using the applications over the infrastructure, get the information, and apply it in their given setting. Right? With me so far. Well, what evidence do we have that this pressure for participation is there, is coming, is real? Well, if you go back and you look at the internet is really just an ongoing conversation and agreement. There really isn't an internet, right? We all know this conceptually, though we treat it like it's a thing. But I've used your public Wi-Fi, and you already know if you've ever used your public Wi-Fi, it's not the full internet, right? Oh, we won't let email actually get in and out, but the web works fine, right? So people agree what goes in and what goes out. But they also agree to send data. I mean, really, it's people of networks that agree to speak a common language and agree to transfer data. And now with net neutrality, or I like how ALA is talking about is net equity, the idea of at what level and how, what obligation do I have to send this information back and forth. This is a really interesting model. And the internet was pretty revolutionary when it put this together in the late 60s, early 70s that said it's all an agreement of sending this information. Because if you think back to the 70s and 80s in particular, there were a lot of wide area networks that were not participatory. AOL, CompuServe, Prodigy. We can come up with, you know, even freenets with dial-ups. And what's happened is those were very authoritarian, non-participatory. Our infrastructure is what we give you. We don't allow you to influence, shape it, participate in the infrastructure level. Going to CompuServe and saying, I want more bandwidth, is a ridiculous conversation. But now, look at where all those are. The only one that I know that still exists is AOL, and it's not really in the infrastructure business like it used to be, or if it is, it's adopted this model. So the pressure to say how we build networks is participatory shows up at the infrastructure level. When we look at the application level, open source is a clear example of people saying, I don't want to just get what you give me. I want to be part of it. Right? So with AOL, I don't like your email package. Too bad. No, now I can put in Thunderbird, and I can do Eudora, or I can do Outlook, or I can do whatever. I can pick it. And if I don't find it, I can make my own. Oh, Internet Explorer sucks, and the big evil Microsoft does it. Firefox. Oh, Firefox has been bought by Google. It's horrible. Opera. Right? Oh, I don't have, I'll write it myself. Whatever it is. And this has become practically a philosophy now. But the idea is quality is through participation. Right? And we have some other examples we'll get into in a second. Next level up, which is where we sit, now this pressure goes right to our doorstep that says, I not only want to pick my infrastructure and how I pay for it and such, I not only want to pick the tools that I show up at your door with, I now want to be very much in charge of how I organize your information. I want to take your crime statistics, Chicago, and see it in a GIS way. What? Chicago Police Department, you don't provide it? No problem. Google Maps. And now I can do these mashup things. I want to come in and say, I don't only want you to tell me what book you've got. I want to tell you what I think of your books. Right? Comments and annotations. But what's happening here is not just people generously saying, I'll give you my information and, oh, I'll become famous. They're actively trying to construct the world around them. What's social and participatory is because they're trying to learn, not because people just sort of naturally want to show off. There are still people who naturally want to show off. But, right? And then at the use level, which we're going to talk about, you're really seeing a way in which people define what is credible information. How do they define credibility? And we're going to talk about this in a second. Don't tell me what's credible. I'm going to figure out what's credible. All right? So what I'd like to do is take this concept of knowledge is created through conversation. And I want to look at the implications. If we look at library functions and tasks with this lens, as opposed to we're in the thing business, we're in the archiving business, we're in the artifact business, we give you information, therefore you learn in a passive way. And I want to take, what is it, if we look at it, conversation and participatory, what's its implications for things like credibility, catalogs, reference? We could do this with other things from archiving. For example, archivists always sort of sit in the library and going, we're not quite sure why we're here. And librarians always say, we're not quite sure why you're here. But if what you say is, there are really important conversations that occur in artifacts, and we don't want to lose those conversations
Preservation makes sense. Reference. Well, you know, we do all this cataloging and technical stuff, and then there are these crazy idiots in front of a desk who do the reference stuff. Why are they here? Well, if what you're doing is you're facilitating conversations that you may well bring resources to, and those conversations may have artifacts and may need to be preserved, it sort of links these things. I think we've, as a field, have intuitively understood that we're all in the same business. But if you look at the theory we use, and if you look at the writing, you look how we organize ourselves, we sort of fundamentally say, well, yeah, we're all in the same business, I just don't talk to them. Or I'm not quite sure I'm in the same business as you, but okay. But, you know, if you suddenly say, look, we're having conversations, and those conversations need to be started, facilitated, enriched, and preserved, it begins to make sense why these things aren't, you know, I think it's an intuitive understanding we can begin to make explicit. So what I want to do is I want to bring up a lens here, which is the lens of conversation. And into that lens, I'm going to feed one of these concepts like credibility. Thank you. And out of it, we're going to talk about how that concept is transformed, right? Because it would be real easy to say, great, we solved this problem and walk away, but I think there's some fundamental changes we need to make. By the way, for me, this is also the answer to this morning's presentation about why how people don't see libraries doing social networks. I don't either. I see libraries as being participatory organizations. And what's the difference? Well, they're not. But what was really interesting was that bubble, that statistics that said libraries shouldn't do social stuff. And then you said, what do libraries do well? And they said, learning. And if learning is a participatory activity, okay. So it's a bait and switch. I also want to make a warning here, which is by picking these different areas and sort of looking at them in detail, it's going to seem a bit discontinuous at first, right? Oh, so here's how cataloging works. And I'm sort of going to be artificially breaking these pieces apart. But really, I think these are concepts that begin to pull systems together, that we begin to say, why do we have a virtual reference system and a digital library, and how does that impact our bibliographic catalog, and why should we be offering blogs? You can say, these are different aspects of conversation. So let's start with credibility, just to walk through it. And what I'm going to talk about with credibility is right now, a lot of people, when they think about credibility, think about authority. And I'm going to say that once you take that to a conversational lens, credibility really becomes about reliability. So let me break that down. Let's start with some definitions. I'm going to put all this on the web, so there's a citation here. So this first one is a definition that I use for credibility, and it was done by Andrew Flanagan and Miriam Metzger out of University of California. The believability of a source or message, which is made up of two primary dimensions, trustworthiness and expertise. Do I trust it, and do they know what they're talking about? But what's really important is that I emphasize that, to me, credibility determination lies within the individual receiving the information, not in the transmitted information. Right? This is kind of like cataloging. We used to think that the book had magically the cataloging data in it, and all we had to do was extract it and put it into our records. And now we very much realize that metadata and cataloging and classification are really things we apply to an object. Right? This is the same thing. That there's not some intrinsic quality of the information being transmitted. I'm the idiot that always drives everyone nuts because people talk about good information, and I raise my hand and say, please define good here. And that credibility is not conferred by the source of that information. So you can't make something credible. I, giving you information, cannot make you have credible information. You're the one who's going to determine whether it's credible or not. Right? This is why Pope Benedict and I don't get along. I'm a relativist. He's not. My Italian's also not. German's not that good, I should say. So a couple other definitions to throw into this. What do I mean by shifting from authority to shifting to reliability? An authority definition or approach to credibility is using a trusted source in place of a given individual's credibility decision. So if you're using an authority model, what you're doing is you're abdicating your decision. You're saying, well, it came from them and I trust them. Right? I pick on George, always a bad example. But, you know, I like George. George sent me a book and said it's good. I'm going to assume it's good because I trust George. Not because I went and did it, but that's what authority is. This is what we try. What's scary is this is really what the education system is beaten into students. Oh, if it comes from .edu or .gov, it's good. That's an authority decision. Now, I happen to build .edu sites, and I've been working in .gov sites, and I wouldn't trust me. So this idea that authority works. So we saw, all right, reliability is seeking consistency across a range of sources. And I want to give you a real specific example of where these two things came. The Hurricane Katrina example. Hurricane Katrina came in, bad things happened. One of the bad things that happened is that people were going to traditional authorities for authoritative answers, and they weren't getting them. They were getting contradictory information. They were getting wrong information. They were getting bad information. And this authority model broke down. FEMA doesn't know what it's doing. The state doesn't know what it's... No one knows what it's doing. The people I'm supposed to go to, the authorities, don't know what they're doing. What happened was there was a site called NOLA. It was built up in association with the local newspaper, and they had always had these forums to talk about community issues. NOLA broke them down to neighborhood-by-neighborhood levels, and what happened is people were starting to get up there and say, how did you get the FEMA trailer? How did you get the ice? What did this happen? And what happened is people became experts, because when they gave information, the information became verified by multiple sources, and they became authorities, right? But this reliability information is the idea that I seek lots of different topics and agree or not. So one of the, you know, on a much lighter example, you know, I like to cook. And if I'm going to cook chicken cordon bleu, I don't go find the recipe and cook it. I oftentimes will find four or five recipes and say, they all have chicken. I'm going to go with that. They all have ham. I'm going to, right? It's this notion that, you know, have you ever checked weather.com and said, yeah, but I'm really going to check the local ABC affiliate to see what, right? You take on the onus of checking multiple sources, right? What you are doing from the conversational standpoint is you are shaping the knowledge around you. You're actively constructing this information world. And in fact, people like tools because if they can bring them in and snap them together, they can construct the space around them. They're participating in this. Now, what's interesting also is that we find that users go to participation, right? So this statistic, I know you can't read it necessarily, what you see, this little line down here is Encarta.com, and this little line way up here is Wikipedia. Now, the traditional answer to this line is good enough. Oh, people just took the easy stuff. Oh, it was just good enough information. The digital library world, of which I am partially to blame, forever has looked at these statistics and dismissed them and simply said people are satisficing, which is a technical thing because it won a Nobel Prize in economics, so it must be true. That, and it is, but people are just taking the least, you know, the road of least resistance. Well, here's the problem with that analysis. This was freely available on the web. This was freely available on the web. This is not, you know, if it's not like it was harder to do one versus the other, right? What's happening, my theory, and if you follow the theory of conversation, this allowed people to not only add their own information, they could audit their information, look at the reliability of the information by who said it, how many people said it over time, and they could actively construct the information space around them. Here, they were stuck with Encarta, and they didn't necessarily know what happened behind the Iron Curtain of how decisions were made. I got a reporter who called me talking about the authority of Wikipedia. And she goes, well, aren't you afraid that people's biases will influence their articles? I said, have you read an Encyclopedia Britannica from 1901? Look at indigenous species of any country and see if there's maybe a bias in there, right? There's tons of biases in there. But the point is that they were sort of hidden or behind the scenes or non-participatory. You couldn't actively engage the biases. You couldn't actively deal with the biases, construct a world around or an account for it. Here, suddenly you can. This is my encyclopedia. This is not my encyclopedia. This is my system that I can participate in, have a conversation with other people, and create, learn knowledge. This is disseminated to me. All right? So it's more than just good enough. And the important thing is that Web 2.0 tools allow participation, but this is a concept that's going to be there for 3.0 and 4.0 and 5.0. And when we get to, you know, it's like Library 2.0. My standing joke is, can't we at least be at, you know, version 12.5 beta? You know, we've been around for a couple thousand years. Anyway. Other examples of where of this shift from authority to reliability, really a shift from passive acceptance to active participation. Electronic voting. If you follow the electronic voting world, you know that there's huge, huge fights about whether they're valid or not. But look at what they're really fighting at. They're fighting at source code. What's amazing to me is you have this active cornerstone of democracy that has people passionately discussing source code, right? This philosophy that One philosophy says, which is an authority approach, if I am a credible organization with credible security mechanisms and a good reputation, you can trust me. And in fact, by locking away the source code so they, the bad people, can't see it, I'm making a more secure system. The people on the other end said, no, you've got to open source this, because until everyone can look at the bugs and everyone can see them and everyone can test it, everyone can try and break it, I'm not going to trust it. Open source software said, these are two different models, authority model, reliability or participatory model. Amazon, once again, we're going to look at Amazon a little bit, but it's the idea that not only do you give me the books and do you give me the expert reviews, you give me everybody else's reviews and I can look across those reviews and I can build consistency. So the ability to participate is becoming a factor in credibility, and ultimately it's beginning to supplant authority. People are becoming their own authorities. Right? Did you ever, growing up, I mean, we can all play the age game, but I'm looking around and we're all safe on this one. Did you ever think growing up that you would be a meteorologist? Yet how many people look at weather radar to see if it's going to rain in the next 15 minutes? Right? What's that all about? I'm addicted to it. I can't go out. I can go out. I can't go out. I can't go out. Right? But that's the notion that certain things and by the way, there's always going to be a blending of these. I'm making this sort of really hyperbolizing the difference here. But, you know, there are certain things you're going to be an authority for. There are certain things you're going to move reliability. But with the amazing amount of information that's available to us, and more importantly, the tools to take that information and put it into our contexts, we can now become an authority, our own authorities on more and more and more subjects. Medicine is a clear example. Medicine scares the hell out of me. I have a very good friend with cancer. Walking in with cancer and having the doctor say, you can do this, you can do this, one of them will kill you. We're not sure which, and it's your decision. That's bizarre, right? Medicine, by and large, has become an issue of becoming your own expert. Finances are becoming, your retirement account is becoming your own expert. What happens is industry has also looked at this, and they're beginning to abdicate authority. They're beginning to get rid of it and say, no, now it's all your problem. How do librarians fit in this? And this is tacky, but I'm doing self-citation because I didn't want to have to rethink how I'd write this. The resistance. Yeah, there you go. The resistance. You have to decide yourself. Right. The resistance to the democratization of authority among librarians is ironic because there are few professions better suited to the authoritative world of the internet than libraries. They have a culture of open and free expression and access to ideas. They are generalists who move agilely across different topical domains. They are skilled at searching out information and locating potential biases. Their enterprise, libraries, have little invested in the production of information and much invested in the consumption of it from a wide variety of sources. Further, librarians already have a reputation as authoritative, not authoritarian. Right? I'm throwing another term in there. Right? The authoritarian view is libraries say, we only collect the good stuff. Right? Or often phrased as, our collections are for the next generations. Right? This idea that libraries will become the place for good information. Right? This is where I get into fights. So I usually win them, but no. One's with Eisenberg, and you just never win against Eisenberg. And that is the idea that librarians are somehow gifted by God and their degrees to pick good information. And I say, that's crap. I say librarians have no special ability to pick good information from anyone else. What librarians are good at and trained at and important at is picking good information for a patron, for a question, for a topic, for an area, right? We need the question in order to be good. We need to have a participatory system in order to perform well. If not, we build collections that make perfect sense to us and no one else gets them. Right? And so, you know, this is the idea that somehow libraries become the ivory tower that only preserve the good stuff, and the good stuff is whatever we don't actually have to talk to other people about is nuts, because librarians are really good at determining good stuff for other people, from participating, from being part of that system. So we sort of wanted to do a quick experiment. I'm just going to run through this quickly. And what we wanted to do was think about how we could take advantage of this. How could we take advantage of that librarians are authoritative, but they're authoritative in sort of this reliability mode. In other words, we don't go to someone and say, it's good or it's bad, but that they do it from a question. And what we did is we tried to look at a search application we called Reference Extract. And the question we started with is, what's the utility of the knowledge base? And this is one that Paula and I are pulling our hair out, obviously me more successfully than she, for a long time. And what we wanted was something that was high effect, something that was really a useful tool with low effort, and that preserved patron privacy because it was important to the community. So what we needed to figure out was, would this thing provide a high credible source? So what we did is we looked at the full text of about 375,000 reference transactions. We pulled all the URLs out of them, right? Because you can't say a URL is a private thing, right? Your Google's my Google, right? And we took, not only did we take them, but we also calculated the frequency by which they were cited, right? So in other words, not just what the URL was, but how many librarians cited it how many times. We took these URLs and we spidered them. We just went out, we grabbed a spider, and we went and indexed them just like Google did. And then what we did is we brought the weights back in from the frequency counts and we manipulated the results. All right, that's a real long way of saying we built a search engine. But rather than using Google PageRank, the more times something's linked to, we used what we called reference weighting, the more times reference librarians pointed to a site. By the way, really interesting stuff that you may not expect. Can I share this, the September surprise? In question point for September, the number one cited URL? Wikipedia. Okay.
What a surprise!
But amazing! Right?
And that's also across the world, too.
Yeah, I'm sure. Right? Why? Why would librarians? Because it's easy. It's good enough. Well, we would assume that this population would know better. But so we developed, so we brought this in, and we also did things like when you do this across a bunch of services, you look at their citation patterns. That's what this is. What you're saying is, here are the sites, here are the URLs that were cited, here's the number of times. Now, so this is, I'll go over this quick, but for the geeks in the field, these distributions look really interesting because they're power curves. Well, this one not so much, this one definitely. And so what it does is it says things like, this is the long tail stuff, the rich sites get cited a lot of sites get cited very little. Well, this means it gets really interesting when you build into a search engine because you begin to manipulate the top level of results, but not necessarily the lower level, so you don't necessarily obscure other information. We also then said, all right, so these are the weights that we're going to build in. So we put in a query, back comes an answer, we're going to boost a result based on how many times it was cited. So from the just general text search, one was Google, two was Wikipedia, three was Amazon. But we found that Wikipedia was answered most. So when we present it to the user, we'll go Wikipedia, Google, Amazon. That's boosting. All right. And we started then asking the question, how often do you have to do these frequency counts? Right. So in other words, librarians cited in September Wikipedia the most, but what about August? And what about, you know, October? Right? And so what we figured is it's going to be important when we take how often we take this sample. And so what this next graph is, besides just pretty, these are the citation patterns of two different digital reference services. This digital reference service is AskEric that I ran, and so it ended in 2002. And what's interesting is each one of these colored bands is a site, all right? And what you're seeing at any given slice is time, all right? So it's a bunch of months together. It's actually about 8 years of information, all right? And so what you see is that this site and this site were cited a lot, and these sites less so, right? Now, it might be interesting to know that this site is a site called orders.edrs.gov, which is the ERIC document reproduction, was the ERIC document reproduction service. This site is edrs.gov. Can you tell me when they redesigned their website to incorporate the two together? This is U.S. Department of Education's website. This one, little red down, is AskEric, and Google does not appear on this one. This is the citation pattern of scientists in a site called AskNSDL. So this was, you ask a scientist a question, why this, why is the sky blue, what's a black hole, this kind of thing. And a couple of things are interesting. One, the reason you see such dramatic things are citation, or that scientists do not cite. If you ask a scientist a question, they answer from their own memory. They don't give you a citation. So they're not the ends here is relatively small. But it's also all over the place. So if you were going to take these frequency counts we talked about and build them into a search engine, in AskEric, you could take this really long window. But if you're working off a citation pattern like this, you need to take lots of little small windows so you can keep current. So you're not always bouncing old sites to the top of the result set. And this is just an example of what that site might look like. In fact, what it does look like. And what's interesting is these are the actual URLs that they cited,
meaning we index down to the page level. This is to the domain level, so we sort of backed it up to we just got the domain. So this might be askeric.org/science/... and this is just askeric.org. Okay. So what we started thinking about was that we are really moving across zones of credibility. This is exactly what credible people, librarians, cited. This is extended. These are what the domains in which they cited. Then we thought, well, you could do predicted ones. Based on sort of co-occurrence and nice heuristic algorithms, we could come up with anticipated sites, sites that librarians might like. And then you eventually move into Google. And you sort of, each step, stepping down in terms of perceived credibility by the user. All right. So, that was a long way to go for that. But the idea behind all of this is defining credibility. When we talk about a credible source and what's credible, defining that by conversation, not defining that by source. Right? Now let's take another sort of fundamental aspects of librarians and run it through the machine. So we'll take catalogs. And we're going to talk about how catalogs can move from inventory systems and become really mind maps. So here's the example. This is Syracuse University's main site, and we're going to go searching. And we're going to search for, I don't know, Lankus. Because it's a controllable, unique keyword. But we're actually not going to look for me for a change, because it's all about me. We're going to look for an old ancestor that I actually have no idea if they're related. We're going to look for J.J. Lankus, who was a woodcut artist who worked with E.E. Cummings. And so we can pull up that book. Boom. There it is. All right? So that's a search, and actually a pretty successful one. I mean, let's face it. If you want to give a catalogs a softball answer, give them a nice known item search with a unique, meaty keyword to work off of. But it did a pretty good job. Now we'll throw it against something like Amazon. And we'll throw the same keyword in, and now it's the number one result. You can say, all right, fine, whatever it is. And we can pull up that number one result, and we can see what Amazon does. Now what's interesting, when I give this speech to libraries, I say, how many of you have been in the website redesign process, right? Where you always bitch and moan about your website, now you're going to make it right. And how many during that conversation get around to, it should be more like Amazon? And how many of that does it turn into, it should be simpler and easier to use? And simpler and less clutter and less stuff. Well, let's sort of take that idea for a minute. What we're going to do is, here is the WorldCat record for that same book. That is J.J. Lankus, the woodcuts of J.J. Lankus. That's the entire page. Okay. I know there are tabs in there. Leave me alone. This is the same record from the Library of Congress. Every little bit of metadata they've got on. Here's the one from Syracuse University Library. And here is Amazon's. What in the world? This is not simpler. This is not less. What's going on here? Well, it's all marketing data, right? That top little line is actually branding, but also navigation, search, different features. The next big box here is sales information, but really, sales information is metadata information. It's cost, it's author, it's these kinds of things. The next big band are quality reviews. These are New York Times book reviews, authoritative sources, right? The next band, traditional bibliographic metadata, ISBN numbers. And if you actually add these two boxes together, it's not off of these very much. Mm-hmm. So what's the rest of this? Well, the rest of this are look inside the book, keywords inside the book. The next one are citations. Because if you know, just to take aside, I'm in the conversations. In scholarly academic publishing, it's all about conversations. It's a really slow conversation. But this is why we put citations, and when we go up for tenure, why we worry about citation counts and impacts. Because what you're trying to do is say, what conversation are you a part of? What impact have you had upon that conversation? And how's it working? That's all citations. It's right there. I think a lot of our cataloging efforts are at the wrong end of the book. We spend a hell of a lot of time with front matter, and we need to spend a lot more time with the back matter of a book. We need to spend much more time with what it cites and who cites it than what it's called and how many pages it is. Next group, sponsored links, marketing. We'll just dismiss it, get rid of it. But then let's go at it. Tagging and social tools. Customer reviews. Discussion groups. Pathfinders. Remember when we did pathfinders? And then way at the end, if you ever scroll this far, because God knows if you don't scroll, no one scrolls. So all this is, you know, clearly users don't care because we don't scroll. is traditional marketing information, and the bottom is a history. Right? But what's interesting is all of this is conversational data. It's all about conversations. It's all about people participating. Why are they participating? Because they're learning, reflecting learning, they're shaping their world. One of the things we ask in a traditional education setting is to make you see if you understand something, is to tell us about it. What's your opinion? Be critical about it. Participation. And the end result of this participation is discovery, inventory. This is all about where a thing is, where it fits, and where to find it. They don't care a damn about where it fits and where to find it. They have an inventory system. I guarantee you Amazon has an inventory system. They just don't let you see it. Right? The example I give about inventory systems is it's like going in to buy a shoe. When you go in to buy a shoe and you say, do you have this in a size 13? They look at you and they go behind a desk and they crouch down and hide and they type a few obscure characters and they say, well, yes, we do. Or no, we have it at the Dublin store or the Columbus store, right? They never let the user see it because it's so arcane and cryptic. But libraries just take it and turn it right around and say, good luck. You know, size 13, I don't know. Do a Boolean search, right? I mean, catalog. Catalog is what we order sweaters from, right, on Christmas time. But a catalog in Dewey Decimal System and Cutter numbers, all of this was how to park something. This is not about parking. This is about finding. This is about understanding. This is about comprehending. This is parking. By the way, that book was written in 1991. So I'm not exactly showing you the top seller in J.J. Woodcut Lankus. This is Harry Potter, Sorcerer's Stone. Same idea, a few different sources. Reviews, pathfinders, discussion tools, right? Nuts. What we started to think about is, okay, Dave, you bitched and moaned about the catalog. We're used to bitching and moaning about the catalog. We bitch and moan about the catalog. Bitching and moaning about the catalog is a hobby of mine. What are you going to do about it? So we sort of backed into this question in that we had SU libraries, a SciTech library came to us and said, we want to change how we do electronic reserves because we're about to be sued. No, that's not why. They actually wanted a bigger budget. So they said, think about reserves. So right now, if you're taking a class, you're at Syracuse University, that person told you to read an article, go read it. What they do is they send it over to the library, and they'll scan it or they'll put it up electronically, and you can get it through the web. Okay? So what you do is you go to find a reserve. You then tell them what your instructor is, what your department is, what course it is, and then they give you the bag of results. This is everything you need to read. Okay? We said, we can do better than that. We are living in a Web 2.0 world. We can Web 2.0-ify it. And so we came up with this. Now this is a 2.0 world, let me tell you. First thing we said is, we pay Syracuse University a lot of money to know who we are. Why am I bothering to tell you again? Right? So all right, we solved that problem. So we have your articles, you have your books, you have classes, feeds, because RSS is cool. You got stuff, because we don't know what the hell else you're going to put in here. You got to have friends. It's not 2.0 unless you have friends. We don't know why you need friends. I mean, in general, but particularly here. But we got friends. I'm the lonely guy on MySpace. Like, Tom is my friend. But anyway. So you bring up this article, and here's the bibliographic data. It's sitting there. They said it's very important that we were able to push it to a librarian. We thought that was very cool. We stole this right out of library things, so we should be able to see who else read the article and things of that nature. Got to have a tag cloud. Tag cloud's also cool. By the way, I do like tag cloud. And then it's a mashup because here's the Amazon data. If we don't have it, you can go buy it kind of stuff. And we looked at this and we said, we've solved this problem. And then we looked at this and we said, this is absolute crap. And we said, why is this crap? What's wrong with it? It's got all the bells and whistles. It's got all the stuff. It should work. And what it was is, this is all about the object. It has nothing to do with learning. It has nothing to do with the conversation. It has nothing to do with the individual. It is all about the object. This is what we started referring to as the PDF glorification screen. Right? My job is to make PDF look really damn good. Right? I'm not quite sure that's the role I want to be in as a librarian, is glorifying PDF files, but that's what this does. Right? It's thing-based. What's the difference between a book and an article to a student who has to read it for a class? Nothing. What's the difference between the classes they have to take and why are their articles for their classes separated? That makes no sense. If all I'm doing is retrieving things,
what do my friends have to do with this? My friends are in other classes reading other books. It doesn't have anything to do with this. So we sort of rethought this and said, this is not it. We need to say, what is this thing and what's it going? So we came up with design number two. Design number two is different. Design number two, first of all, we start with friends. We'll get to friends in a second. Conversations. It has nothing to do with whether it's a book. It has nothing to do with artifacts. It has nothing to do with the characteristics of the artifacts. It has solely to do with why are you talking about this? What are you learning? What are you thinking about? Those may be classes. Those may be your next great novel. It may be the kegger you're preparing for Friday night. I don't care. They're all here. And what we do is we begin to populate it. The first thing we can populate a class with is a syllabi. Think about a syllabi for a moment. If you've all been to college, I'm sorry to take you back there. But a syllabus, I mean, there's really no unit which is more about conversation on a university than a class. Right? The idea is it's a learning situation. It's a symposium. We're having a class. We should have a conversation. And the syllabi is the first start. What a syllabi does is it's sort of a one-way conversation of the instructor to the student. Here's the bounding that I'm giving you on the topic. Here are the nature of the topic. Here are the items that you need to know about the topic. Here's the sequence of the... They're having a tractable, relational conversation. What's amazing to me, though, is when you go into a catalog and you find a book and it's part of a class, you can't relate that book to any other nature in the class because the catalog's about the book, not about the conversation. So first we have that. That syllabi points to objects. So say it points to a book, it points to an article. But what's more than just pointing to it, it also gave you some connective tissue, right? It says why I'm pointing to this book, or this is a great example. But it also has assignments. So the student can come to this page not only to get their readings and find out what they're related to, but they can also come to start organizing their own assignment. Well, the assignment was to find an image, and I found this image. This picture prompted me to write the artist. Here's the response, and here's the email from the response. Now what the student begins to do is not only populate it with their own information, some from the library, some not, not only relate that information together and how it works, but it's sort of they're building a mind map. They're building a cognitive structure of how this information is related. Now here's where it gets interesting. This is where the friends come in. So I'm reading this book and I take notes. And I say, I'm going to make those notes public. Let me see anyone else in my class who made those notes public. So now you can be sharing notes. Well, let me see what other notes are on this one that may not be from my class. Boy, this is an architecture class, and I'm seeing notes here from art history. Huh. Let me go look at the art history books. What's the relation? Even though Dewey or Library of Congress wouldn't class those things right next to each other, according to this conversation, they're co-located. And so this idea that conversation is co-location is still useful. Dewey, Library of Congress, is a really useful, interesting conversational mechanism for organizing materials. The problem is it's not participatory. It's one conversation. It started with a guy named Melville, right? And we know that Melville clearly wasn't a big fan of non-Christian religions or women because, you know, the classification kind of shows up that way, right? But the idea that that's a conversation. It's an answer to the question, how do I organize the world? But it's one answer and one conversation. Here, suddenly, this is this person's conversation. And they may use another conversation in another class or another syllabus or Dewey or Library of Congress or whatever to reorganize the information how they need. But the point is they can make sense of this. They can follow it. They can reconstruct it. It's one of the things we talked yesterday about lists. The problem with lists and tagging is if I make you a it's like, tell me your favorite books. I'm going to come back in 2 years and show you that list and say, what's this list of? And you're going to say, books. And I like that one. Right? Or what we know from research is, as human beings, we hate being wrong. I mean, it's actually coded in our DNA, so we will reconstruct a reason for those things to be together. Right? My favorite line from Doctor Who, I love humans because they find patterns even when they don't exist. We will do that. Right? But now I can say, this is how I organize the world at this time. Right? So then, when you pick on one of those items, then it makes sense to have the glorification of the PDF, right? This stuff still makes sense, but this thing, it makes sense to me, right? How do these things relate together to me, right? And so one of the examples I give is the idea that we used to talk in databases and catalogs in particular about noise reduction. Less noise in the catalog. Get it cleaner. Right? We want less distractions. I think catalogs, as well as physical libraries, need to be noisy, noisy, noisy places, right? And the example I give is, in a place-based physical setting,
we had a situation where it's like trying to collect conversations at rush hour at Grand Central Station. You couldn't do it. What you want to do is stand up on a big platform and say, everyone having a business conversation over here. Everyone having a personal conversation over here. Anyone talking about sex? Over here. You two, over there. Right? So, 2, 3, 4. Okay. But that's how you do it. In physical settings, the way you capture these things is you reduce it, you separate it. But now think about, as you sit here, thousands of radio waves are penetrating your body. Right? And those radio waves from cell phones and radios and everything are conversations, but they're not interfering with this one. They're passing right through. And if you take out a piece of equipment, you can tune into them. And not only can you tune into them, but on a radio, you can co-locate them, things and everything. The idea is to give people the tools to filter, reduce, shift, and choose the noise, not to eliminate the noise. By eliminating the noise, you're eliminating the possibilities for them to construct their space. You're eliminating their participation in the system. You are becoming an authoritarian, dictating the structure of information to people, as opposed to allowing them to construct their own world. And so at any point here, someone can come in and add another node, right? So I read this and I got this email back from the author, and I decided that made me, he told me to look at a web page. So I'm going to add the web page here. And not only do I get to sort of click and add the web page and decide whether I want to make it public or not, I can tell you why. I can put the connective tissue in so I can reconstruct this. So at a later point, I can hit save as, lit review, and here comes. APA cited, here's your connective tissue, which are the connecting paragraphs, and I have an annotated bibliography. Right? What we also discovered is this gives us an ability to migrate from the static, thing-based, one conversation model of our library catalogs to a conversational system. Right? When someone was adding a book or an item here, it came from the catalog. This is just a database of artifacts. We need those. We need an inventory system. We need an inventory system. But here we begin to add these to our conversations. Over time, as people have more and more and more conversations, and they begin to link their conversations together, the value of this as an inventory system remains, as a discovery tool, shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. So now when you search for information, you may still pull up that book, but now you can say, by the way, would you like to know about this book in the sense of art history, or would you like to know about this book in the sense of architecture? If you're interested in architecture, someone's had, a doctoral student has done a dissertation that he's provided to share, and here's some related resources on that. And so suddenly we can surf the conversations. We can skim and move through the conversations, right? So, well, I don't have time. All right. James Burke. Hey, some of you have heard this before. Great author, historian and broadcaster, came up with Day the Universe Changed and Connections, and he had a great example of why the North winning the Civil War led to the modern computer revolution. Right? And the way it is, North should have lost the Civil War because the South had more troops, and the common military idea at the time was more men on the field, you win. But the North had industry, and so they could bring more artillery. Artillery balanced out the men. Problem with artillery is you can't point and go bang because you have to shoot in an arc over ballistics to figure out how far and at what angle you have to figure out the area under an arc, which is calculus. Not too many Northern soldiers or Southern ones knew calculus. I still don't. So what they did was they had people in the factories producing the cannons produce a table. They were calculators, and actually called computers at the time, who would compute if they're at 500 meters, do it at this angle, and go boom. And they'd send this table along. In World War I, this was still the common understanding. In World War II, the idea of more artillery, more victory. The problem is we were facing Germany. Germany had as great, if not greater, industrial capacity. So it became an arms race where we're producing more and more and bigger, bigger caliber. We need to do more and more of these tables. We ran out of people to do the tables. We needed to automate it. We came out with ENIAC. ENIAC was a binary computer, but it ran on vacuum tubes, and vacuum tubes are terribly finicky. And so they blow up on a regular basis. But then we discovered if you wafer silicon together, you create a semiconductor. And the great thing about this is they serve vacuum tubes at low voltage, and you can shrink them, and you can get 1, 2, 50, 100, thousands, millions on one single chip. That became an integrated circuit. That became your CPU. Therefore, the modern computer revolution. Thank you very much. Thank James Burke. But my idea behind that is not a linear or causal trip through history. You wouldn't find all those books in Dewey under Civil War, right? And I keep picking on Dewey, but you can pick. We could do an art example and pick the Getty Art Thesaurus. One conversation doesn't capture that. But wouldn't it be interesting to be able to surf across multiple conversations and be able to find those relationships
and be able to search for something and find whole new areas you hadn't thought of and be able to filter and say, I don't want the conversations of Dave because he's an idiot, but I do want the conversations of Susan because I like her. Right? So, one last. Right? But we know this already. This is just an example of different library systems we have in the library. You can't read them, but that's okay. You know, we have reference systems and digital collections and databases and all this stuff. And we already know that these aren't integrated, that we can't follow the conversations through these things. We can't actively construct our world on this, and we start to solve it. So we see the library world working hard on things like federated searching and recommender systems, digital repositories. But there's still second steps. This actually begins to form a trajectory where we're really building repositories of community data, recommendations, their worlds, their shapes, their blogs, their feelings, and enhanced bibliographic data of artifacts. There's a natural point at which these will merge into a truly participatory system where you won't go to the catalog or go to the reference system. Or you'll go to your library, and you'll be able to create these conversations, have these conversations. And if you find a book, that's great. And if you find a book that's everyone reads the same book, you can find the book group that's talking about it, and you can find artifacts, and you can find conversations and people to talk to, and then you get your book groups. But the book groups are part of this, not yet another frickin' service to add on top of this. I mean, I want to be real clear here. One of the things we said in the tech brief is, don't add yet another system that libraries have to support. I mean, you could say, oh, God, not another OCLC product, but you're not the only ones to blame, right? Oh, we'll now blog. And we throw blogging on top of this. We train someone for blogging. They write about the library. No one reads it because patrons really love to know what it's like to be a reference librarian and change toner. And we wonder, and they say, it's failed, and I'm never going to blog again. And why should I? Because that was just extra effort anyway. So let's throw blogs and wikis up here, and now we're going to Twitter, and now we're going to do Photoshop. If we keep doing this, we crush ourselves. Not only do we crush ourselves, but if we don't fundamentally change these to participatory systems where people can actively construct their information, we're ultimately becoming less and less and less and less and less and less and less relevant. Right? So one last one of these transformations, a much quicker, because really that's what we're here to talk about this week, so very formative. How can we move reference from a Q&A into truly a learning system? And there are some problems we can identify, existing problems we've identified in the reference process, things like context is essential. Right? I found in my dissertation that users are treated as questions in services. Right? Because of our privacy, we don't really do customer management. So every new question that comes into a virtual reference service is treated as unique. Oh, Dave. Nice to meet you. It's like we have Alzheimer's. Oh, Dave, nice to meet you. Let me tell you about, you know, restaurants in Columbus. Oh, Dave, hi, nice to meet you. You know, let me tell you about hospitals in Columbus. Oh, Dave, nice to meet you. Let me tell you about salmonella poisoning. These clearly can't be related, right? So, Makiko Maiwa, in her dissertation, found out that people use the same words to ask very different questions. It's like a homonym for reference. It's a homosynonym. Same words that mean the same thing, but you can take them off in the test. And that was the idea that she looked at an information problem-solving process. I'm going to finish up here. I know I'm going a little long. But she said, you know, if you're at the beginning of a research process, you ask, tell me everything about a topic. And so if you're a doctoral student entering a dissertation, tell me everything about virtual reference. And you're looking for as big a pool as possible so you can swim in there and find something. If you're the day before you're about to defend the dissertation, you may well ask the exact same question. Tell me everything you know about virtual reference, but what you're looking now is you're looking, did you miss anything? Right? Or you're looking for the new stuff. But the same words, different question, different interpretation. We hope that a reference interview gets at some of that, but imagine if we could get the context with the question. Talk about that in a second. With knowledge bases, what's the use of these questions over time? We know that now we have things like context dependency. So if someone asks for, I need a good restaurant, this is for me, not for you, so I can read it. I need a good restaurant in Austin for the lactose intolerant, you may get a really good answer. Next time someone asks for a good restaurant, you may not want to give them the same one, right? Because that lactose intolerance is kind of important at the end of that. Metadata creation. What LC class do I assign swimming pools in the Kremlin? I mean, the idea of taking time to catalog questions, nuts. Chunking. I need all the articles by Robert Taylor and Tefco. Is that one question? Is that two questions? Right? How do we break those up? Fact shifting and temporal dependency.
What is the height of Mount Everest? Now, one, Mount Everest is growing. We all know that. So you just say, oh, it's easy. We'll add 2 inches every year, and we'll know the answer. The problem is that the Chinese decided to go find out again how tall it was, and they used, like, the last time anyone had figured out the height of Mount Everest was, like, 20 years ago. So they decided, rather than using, like, people yodeling from the top of the mountains, they used GPS and laser sights and whatever, and they found out that it, I believe, had been given 20 meters of extra height. So it's actually 20 meters, you know, which is kind of important if you're trying to fly over it. But, you know, things change. Who is the president? All this kind of stuff. So we have problems in the reference process that I think we can begin to solve if we take this conversational approach. And you remember this slide. What if when I ask a reference question, rather than simply saying, what is this, and then hoping that the reference interview and conversation, I could say, here's my world on this question. This is going to contain everything I've already consulted. This is going to contain the relationships I see. This is going to contain things that I rejected. And I'm willing to build this because this is my learning. This is my space. I'm inviting the reference librarian into my space to collaborate, as opposed to leaving my space, whatever it is, talking to the reference librarian to get some information, which may or may not be relevant, or how much time do I have to get, bring you up to speed, getting some information, coming back into my space, and relating. Why can't I, in essence, invite them to my space to collaborate on this in a real-time setting? Right? So these are just some of the things we've talked about this week. But bottom line, I put this slide at the beginning because I know I just threw like 5,000 different little projects and websites at you, and it seems like, oh, great, we can just reinvent everything and come up with 50,000 new problems. But what I want to point out is that this is really much more of an integrative view. If we begin to think instead of the library as a collection of collections, which is how we really sort of think about libraries now, we've got our databases, which have their own organizational schemes, and usually thousands of them depending on our budget. We've got our repository of things that we scan. We've got our digital library. We've got our catalog. And the reference librarian brings it all together magically, or the website designer, no doubt, will make it very easy for us all to get around it, or we'll wait for WorldCat. I'm sure they'll do that. But this is the view. What if instead of this view, which is artifact-centered, look at this. What this is these are these kinds of artifacts, these are these kinds of artifacts, these are these kinds of artifacts. What if instead we looked at the library as a collection of users' libraries, where this user comes in and says, here's my pictures from my personal computer, or that I uploaded because you allowed me to, or they're on Flickr and I just use their API to bring it in. Here are some good websites in my delicious list or whatever it is that I include. Here are the assets that the library provides me in whatever form it is. But this is my view. And this is this person's view. And this is this person's view. And the library are these people and their conversations. And now you can begin to do social stuff. Right? But the social stuff you're doing is not just because these two people happen to be next to each other and they are willing to tag. The reason you do it is say, this is your learning space and your view of the world. Did you want to enrich your view of the world with other people's views of the world? And now it becomes a learning process. What can I learn from this person? Because I'm willing to do that because in learning, I'm in participatory mode. If I'm not learning, I'm in entertainment mode. I'm in passive mode. Don't bother me. But when I'm in learning mode, I'm willing to take on greater cognitive load, and I'm willing to do more to get that value back. So that was me talking way too long about way too much stuff. What did I screw up, and what did I miss, and what did I get wrong?
Mm-hmm. What if I just wrote a book?
The one I did?
Yeah.
Find a book?
I didn't have a,
let's see.
I mean, there is a way just to
yeah.
Okay, I don't have to create a whole matrix to find Huckleberry Finn.
No, I mean, okay. I don't think I drew it in the reserve system, but, you know, search box here, right? The idea being that, but, I can at least associate that query with that item, right? So you may not actively be constructing this wonderful thing, but on the back end, I'm collecting these relationships so that as they begin to be included and I find out, everyone's searching for this, pick this book, right? This is Amazon's recommender system. Well, catalogs can do that from how people are seeking information as well. So this is, yeah, clearly these are people who want to turn into a mode where they're willing to take on this cognitive load. But the problem we have now is we don't even give them the choice.
Right. Yeah, that's
right. So granted, there are going to be times when people, they don't want to turn their library into their universe and then bring other sites. This may be just another site they go to. But they're not going to come to us if they can't see themselves in there after a time, when they don't have that ability. So, good point. Questions from the phone? That's always a good delaying mechanism, right? I shouldn't stand like this because I look like I'm ready to pounce, don't I? I'm sorry. Yes. Oh. Yeah, that was an interesting one. I'm trying to think. Oh, I was having a virtual reference conversation with the National Library of China, and she said, all this virtual reference stuff, why bother? Why can't they just call them on the phone? I said, do you have a phone? She goes, yes, I do. I said, do you ever text someone with the phone? She goes, yes. I said, why don't you just call them? Right? And in fact, what's interesting is, this is one way to display it, but why not on your cell phone be able to see it as a linear list, right, for low text output, or with screen readers, or, you know, those different views. So, but
it's kind of weird how it works with people who need screen readers.
Well, this is, frankly, it's a mock-up. It's great. It would work, but it's, no. But the idea is that these are also objects, so they have in them, they're intelligent behind them, meaning you know this is a picture, and you know pictures can do certain things, and you don't display them to screen readers. You know this is a book, and some people can handle bibliographic data, some people just want titles, as opposed to just blob, right? I mean, what drives me nuts is when you go to a catalog and you find a book and it's part of a series, but nothing in the catalog tells you that. And what you want to do is sort of grab the catalog and pull it up and see the relationships between the items in you know, this book is cited by this and this book is, right? And that's another form of conversation. One is where as a patron I'm actively creating the world. The other is to find browse other people's. And some are like in scholarly works, citations already there. Let's just expose it. In almost every catalog, there's a classification scheme. It's already exposed, but it's just one thing. You got the idea of tagging is sort of a way to get at it, but the idea is to have lots of different ways to connect this stuff, and then let the user intelligently and efficiently filter through till they find the conversation that they want to sort of follow or join or create. Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, gorgeous, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, partly it's if we imagine for a minute that this is, we're going to stick with some crazy terminology, a node. So think of it as a book, right? This is going to be a WorldCat record. And this is going to be another WorldCat record, and someone has gone in and said they are related. Whether that's by Dewey, they're co-located, or whether it's me saying I like these books, whatever it is. Someone digs it. And over time, I add another resource, and this time it's going to be a Google page. Someone else has a conversation where they put in a WorldCat item, they put in sort of their own interesting thoughts, they then point to this WorldCat item, and then they come out and they begin pointing to another Google page or something of that nature. They might just put a standing query in. Right, but all right, but let's make it more explicit. They point to a URL. Good point. All right. Now, what's interesting is, I'm getting there. If I'm not getting there, you're going to yell at me. Just with this very simple interaction, this node is interesting because it's sort of a joiner for two different conversations. You can imagine over time that number is going to be like digs. People are, in essence, voting for that node. In some way, they're saying that node is of use, right? And the way you can begin to expose that as interesting is if you did a search where someone put in a query and one of the results was, in essence, that node, you could say, here's that node, by the way, you know, and here's the abstract on it, and here are the conversations that it's part of. Did you want to follow any of them? Or it turns out that you can say really interesting things like, this node has been used predominantly in the arts. But it's also been used a little bit, I mean, you can actually do it visually, in architecture. And it's been used a really itty little bit in literature. Right? So you can visually, but that notion of how much is it used, how is it related, what's the next thing, what's the previous thing, suddenly is different. It's based on, this is the social side, right? The participatory side, the individual side, is I went to the extra of constructing it. But by allowing that individual effort to become a social good, to become a social property, it gains value. And so this is, I'm doing the individual activity, but I can begin to show the social nature of this. And it's not, I like how it was put this morning, it's not making this social. It's suddenly there's a social good that comes from its use. It's sort of a natural flow out of. And dig, I want to see what lots of people are digging, right? I want to see if they dig this, what it's related to. People went in and did those connections. You could do the same thing here now with all these different kinds of nodes. But it doesn't work unless you get someone to come in and connect them. And the thing with connecting them is people always, whenever you talk about a user doing something, it's, oh, they're never going to do it. Not enough effort, not whatever. But it's payback. If you take, you're actively constructing the world around you. Then it's worth it to me because I'm constructing my world for my learning. It's a very selfish motivation that has a potential social good that comes out of it. So it doesn't get in the way if people want to be altruistic, but it doesn't necessitate it.
That was actually something that we've been talking a little bit about, is that this, for example, is an interface. You know, and it's one way that you can kind of fix in on it, and all of a sudden now we're thinking about building an interface, but the other side points more to the back end, how we have to construct our systems and everything. If you start with this as a goal, you might back engineer yourself into, we've got a year and a half worth of work before WorldCat and nodal connections and all the rest of that happen. But if you start by saying, next week we've got to get a flash designer to build this, we don't have the back end to support it yet.
Yeah.
That's some of what we've been talking about. How do you lay the architecture?
Yeah, one of the problems we find in the knowledge base is a big blob of text. The output of a chat session is a big blob of text. And so doing things like show me that thing I showed you with reference extract about give me all the URLs, whether you like it or think it's worthwhile or it's not, just the ability to ask for all the URLs, the frequency counts, is hard in a blob of text because you do string matches and you get some dirty data and then you got to do counts. Whereas if you at least start with the idea of, oh, I'll just look for every URL object, count them all and hand them to you, you could do that interface so it looks like a Google search. You can do this interface so it looks like a cool little things bouncing around the screen. You can do a text-based reader, but I know that I'm not going to send them the full abstract because I'm SMSing them. But yeah, you've got to have, these have to be sort of intelligible, computationally useful structures to do that. And I think that's where a lot of standardization efforts fail, is that they start with, let's make this an atomic unit. And they sort of assume that they have to take, it's a little fear of mine with the semantic web, that somehow this unit has to be prepared for every context in which it may be used, right? So I have to know every sub, this is the classic thing of how do you deal with the limitations of Dewey? You catalog it, you classify it both in Dewey and LC, right? And we'll just add another metadata layer on top and another metadata layer on top and another, and so pretty soon you have a record that's this big and like 3 gigabytes of metadata associated with it. Just in case anyone wants to know the PIX version of this, right? Whereas if you keep it relatively simple, it's got attributes that are pretty universal, and you let the people put in the semantic links based on what they're, not anticipated use, but actual use, over time you will begin to build those sort of semantic networks that you can do interesting things with. Thank you all for your time. I appreciate it.